Art by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Krannert Center debut artist, pianist Wei Jane Chen, in a Sunday Salon Recital performance on May 2nd. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, they're featuring foods from Italy, including Italian cheeses like Parmigiano, Reggiano, oils, vinegar, Italian chocolates, cookies, and coffee, with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, the story of two sisters who were close as children but grew apart. All grown up, they got to know one another again by riding the bus together. Rachel Simon is a writer. She teaches in the creative writing program at Bryn Mawr College. Her sister Beth has mental retardation. Beth loves to ride the buses through her Pennsylvania hometown. She holds bus pass number one. She knows the drivers. She knows the passengers. And it was a community she wanted to share with her sister, so she invited her sister to ride the bus with her. Rachel Simon has written a book about the trips she made with Beth. Riding the Bus with My Sister was first published 2 years ago. It's now available in paperback. When the book was published, Rachel was contacted by people in the transit industry and in the disability rights movement. As a result, she's been on the road speaking about public transit and disability rights. This evening, she'll speak at the Carl Forum in Urbana, the event made possible with support from the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District, the Developmental Services Center, and WILL. There's a social time at the forum tonight from 6 to 7:30. Rachel Simon's talk begins at 7:30. We have 10 pairs of tickets to the event. If you would like to go, give us a call. Be one of the first 10 callers, and we'll see that you get a reserved seat. The number is 333-7300, 333-7300. If you'd like to see Rachel Simon this evening in Urbana, give us a call, 333-7300. Now, I hope you'll stay tuned for the conversation Rachel Simon and I had about riding the bus. This interview was conducted on September 5th, 2002. Rachel Simon, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This is one cool book. And we'll explain that a little bit later. Okay. Well, to start with, tell us something about your sister. Describe her for us.
Well, I think the first thing that I love to tell people is I love my sister. She's really cool. She's fun. She loves life. She knows how to laugh. She's very quick. She runs everywhere. She's very interested in people, very, very outgoing, although when you first meet her, she's usually shy initially. And I think she's pretty ingenious. She figured out this whole bus thing on her own. Though I also want to add, there may be listeners who don't know people with developmental disabilities, and there's a lot of stereotypical portrayals about them in movies and literature. And one thing I tried really hard to do was capture Beth in her totality so that readers would see that she's a full person with all of the feelings that everybody else has and with flaws as well as strengths. So in addition to the wonderful things I just told you, she also has qualities that are that at times have rubbed me the wrong way and sometimes still rub other people the wrong way, as do we all.
Yeah, well, and when it comes to siblings, we all rub one, and family, we can all rub one another the wrong way.
Yes.
You tell readers that in the winter of your 39th year, you boarded a bus with your sister and discovered that you wanted broader and deeper rewards than those you would find in the big life, and that's capital B, big, capital L, life, big life. Tell us about yourself before and after riding the bus with your sister.
Before I started riding with her, I was, and I still am, a teacher of creative writing. I now still am at Bryn Mawr College. Then I was also at another college. I was also working at a bookstore on events and writing pieces for the Philadelphia Inquirer and writing books and teaching private classes. And that sounds like a mouthful, and it's true. I was really a heavy-duty overworker, and did just really didn't leave time for myself. And partially this was a conscious choice because about 4 years before I had left a long-term relationship, and initially because I was so poor, I started taking on a lot of jobs, and then I discovered to my surprise and delight that when I was so busy with the jobs, I didn't feel how lonely and sad I was. And then it just made me work more and more, and I felt like I was getting somewhere, although every so often I would realize I was really lonely and sad. And you know, sort of in the break between activity A and activity B, I'd go, well, let's get to activity B, and then I don't have to feel that way anymore. So that's where I was when I started riding the buses. And when I finished riding the buses, so much happened. One of the big things that happened was she's in a completely social world, and it made me really have to confront how much I'd isolated myself in spite of the fact that almost everything I did was social, you know, running events, teaching. They're social, but they're not intimate. You know, you can't really share how you're feeling with somebody because you're playing a certain kind of role. And so though I love those, I just wasn't really connecting in a way that I needed. I saw her doing that, and it inspired me to pursue it myself. It inspired me to do it in terms of reviving friendships and also in terms of romance. And I don't know if I should I jump ahead to that? Or
yeah, well, now that you mentioned it, sure. You know, we'll get to the happy ending at the beginning.
Well, my sister's in a long-term romance with a wonderful, wonderful man who in the book I call Jesse. And I think she saw that I was not happy being alone, and I think she wanted me to have more what she had. So she had a little plan, which was to get a bus driver as a brother-in-law, and she sought to fix me up with one. And she seems to have excellent matchmaking skills because she selected somebody who was a very tender-hearted, giving person. And though I think in some ways we weren't suited to each other forever, he was exactly what I needed. He provided me with a safe space in which I could just be myself and relax and remember what it was like to be cared about and to feel that it was okay to share what I was feeling. And I don't want to blow the ending totally for the reader, but because of my time with him, I was able to move into a place of great joy in my love life. And I really credit Beth with fixing me up with Rick to get me to that place. And Rick and I do remain close at this point.
Yeah. This experience has clearly meant a great deal for both of you. You've both gotten one another back, and clearly your sister Beth has brought you out and into life again. But also, you know, I have these two questions. How has riding the bus with Beth changed how you see your sister? And how has it changed how she sees you?
The second question I'm going to have to ponder a little. The first one, I think that the big way it changed how I saw her is when you're raised as a sibling of a person with special needs, one of the things that tends to happen is you take on a feeling of responsibility toward your sibling. You want to protect that sibling. You recognize that there's horrible bigotry in the world, and also that your sibling has it a little harder because of her disability. And so you become protective. And when you get older, it can be very hard to shift from that into allowing her to be her own person and make her own mistakes and make her own choices. And so your protective feelings can actually turn into controlling behaviors, and you may not realize it. Although I think the tip-off really is that you feel really angry that your sibling isn't doing what you want them to do. And you get angrier and angrier the more they don't do what you want them to do. And I think that's a real good sign that you're really trying to control this person. I think I'd seen her as childlike, which was ridiculous because she's not. No one with mental retardation is quote-unquote childlike, and I think this was sort of archaic thinking on my part. By riding with her, I saw her in many different contexts. I saw her a whole range of behavior, and so I saw that there are many areas in which she was very mature and some areas where she was still struggling. And I also got to know people like her wonderful case manager, Olivia, who started introducing me to new concepts like self-determination, which is the major civil rights movement that's been going on among people with developmental disabilities for quite some time now, and I was unaware of it. So in going through all of that, I came to stop wanting to control her, and I came to see her as a full adult. It was a different kind of adult, but still a full adult. It had always bothered me when people said, "What's her mental age?" as if a person can be reduced to a single number, and Beth can be reduced to that no more than you or I. Though, you know, I may say that what my chronological age is, it doesn't mean that at every moment of every day I'm behaving just as you would imagine I would at that age. And it also made me, so in addition to seeing her as an adult, recognizing that she has the right, like all of us, to make her own life choices, and I can try to educate her so she makes what I think are healthy choices and do what I can to assist with that, but let her get there in her own time. That was such an enormous shift for me that I that transformed all my relationships with everyone, from my students to my friends to my love life. And it was very enlightening. So I don't walk around feeling anger now when people don't do what I want them to do. And it's very easy to fall into that trap. And I don't feel that anymore. And that alone helped us get much, much closer. How she sees me differently, I think she likes me a lot more because I stopped trying to control her.
She includes you more.
Oh, my God. Constantly. Yeah. Just this summer, or in the spring, I think. Yeah, in the spring, I got her an 800 number to my phone, and I said, "Now only use it twice a week." So now she's calling, I can't even tell you how many times a day. In fact, I was just talking to her about 10 minutes before this program started. Yeah, I mean, I think she sees me now as a completely integral part of her life. And besides her boyfriend, the person she would turn to most readily at a time of pleasure or pain and rely upon to help her or just to share what she's going through.
What led your sister to make a life riding buses in the city where she lives?
Well, you know, there's, I think for everything we do, there's why we think we do it and why others might realize we did it. And if you ask her, she'll say, for fun, and she'll say because she can get anywhere she wants, although she doesn't ride the buses to actually get anywhere, so that's not really accurate. And then she'll say to hang out with the drivers, because I think she realized drivers, bus drivers, are amazing people. They're kind of like teachers, but they have it much harder than I do as a teacher, because I have one class I have to manage of, you know, 15 people. They have a collection of people they have to manage, but where people are constantly exiting and entering, and at the same time they have to operate the classroom. They have to keep it from colliding with something. I don't have to do any of that. And they need to make sure the people are getting along reasonably well enough that there isn't some crisis on the bus. So it's a great challenge to be a bus driver, but there are many bus drivers who rise to that challenge and are tremendous people. Some of them have gone through the School of Hard Knocks to come to the place they've come to. Many of them, it appears, become philosophers and anthropologists and healers of hurting souls and have committed themselves to really being available to others. And I think Beth realized this and realized what amazing people they would be for her to spend her time with. And when I tell people about this, sometimes people immediately think that they mentor her, but I think in some ways she mentors them. She's a friend of theirs. If they make a wrong turn because maybe they haven't done a certain run in a while, she'll correct them. If they need an errand run, she'll run it. She keeps them company. When she gets on their nerves, she can leave because there's always another bus. So you can depart very quickly, and there's this great sense of independence as a result of that. So I think the drivers drew to the whole thing. When I rode with her, I realized that in addition there were other reasons. One is the incredible sense of independence. It's as if you're almost on this magic carpet hovering one story above everything else and kind of roaming about. And you really, anything you don't like, you leave. And it's almost like a series of little parties because each bus becomes its own community. And sometimes for very brief periods because someone will get on and off, but sometimes they'll cohere for a length of time. And sometimes the people have known each other a long time, and sometimes they're just meeting. So it's all combinations of things. And the tone of the party is determined by the personality of the driver. And each driver, of course, has his or her own personality. So it's all of these different lively experiences to enter and then depart and see the world as you're doing it. It's an incredible sense of freedom. Mm.
Rachel Simon is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Riding the Bus with My Sister, A True Life Journey. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join the conversation with your questions and comments. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Rachel, maybe you would take us aboard, if you'll allow me that, and read an excerpt from the book. This is a portion of the book where you're getting to know one of the first drivers you get to know, a driver named Tim,
mm-hmm.
the professor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is 6 a.m., so this is our first ride. We shiver on a stoop at 10th and Main, peering up the steeply rising street for the first driver of our day's wanderings. Beth looks carefully into the windshield of each passing bus. "That's KT driving," she says. "Sharon, that's Eric." Some she waves to, some, the ones with whom she feels no solidarity, she pretends not to see. She tells me about them all as she shifts her weight back and forth, playing her radio, cupping hands in her sleeves. She makes clear that each bus is distinct, noting their four-digit identification numbers as unique as fingerprints. "Hope you're staying warm," she says to a newspaper delivery girl, the only other pedestrian in sight. Then our bus sweeps around the corner. With a glee, Beth looks through the window to Tim, who is so cheerfully outgoing that Beth has nicknamed him Happy Timmy, though some of his colleagues call him the Professor. Right away, I see the reason for both names as I scale the steps to meet a man who reminds me of the kind of amiable bookworm who might amble down the corridors of my college, lanky, long-faced, intelligent-looking, and 40-ish, with parchment-colored hair, mirthful brown eyes, and a trim goatee. I half expect him to be wearing the rumpled khakis and tweed jacket my jocular calculus professor wore 20 years ago, but there the resemblance stops, as he's clad in the uniform of this company, a bland blue tone somewhere between Union and Confederate. Though above the collar, he sports a wisecracker's grin. "Good morning," Tim says heartily, extending his hand for, not my token, as I erroneously assume, but a greeting. "Welcome to the world's most edifying one-room schoolhouse," he adds, pumping my hand. Only then does he nod toward the fare box. As I slip the token into its slot, I give Beth a look. This is a bus driver? Smiling, she settles into what I already think of as not just her seat, but her throne, which, I realize, is in the most secure, indeed the only, nook on the bus, tucked against the panel that separates the seats from the entry steps. Thus, in addition to being quite literally the driver's right-hand man, "But I'm not a man," she corrects me when I tease her later, she can take in the entire length of the bus at a single glance. Perhaps even better, she can peek over the handrail atop the partition, ensuring that she knows who's boarding before anyone but the driver can see. As before, I sit immediately to her left. I could, though, choose from Tim's entire lecture hall because, as Beth says, I pick runs that aren't crowded, and when the seats get too full, I'm out of here. If I might add an addendum to that, Tim notes, pulling the lever that closes the door. It's because she likes to be the center of attention. "No, I don't," says Beth, with a giggle that belies her words. "I just like to talk." "She fills me in on what every driver's up to, their vacations, their ups and downs," he says to me. "She's the town crier." Then he steers the bus back onto the street, heading up an eastern cut in the mountain, directly toward the sun that's pushing into the morning sky. As he's driving, I follow Beth's gaze, which never wavers from him, and notice that beside his seat, he keeps a quart-sized plastic mug of coffee, a New York Times, and a glossy photography magazine. "Ah, look at the sunrise," Tim says at the first stoplight, lifting his arms toward the windshield. 4 billion sunrises over the dinosaurs, the pharaohs, and now ours today. And no one's ever the same. Isn't it just the most remarkable thing? Each day is fresh and unique, yet each is also a link to every dawn all the way back to the Precambrian. "What's that?" Beth asks. "A long, long time ago," he says, "before there were even people." "You always use big words," Beth says with a touch of disapproval. "I wouldn't want to be around before there were people." She pauses. "Some people." Tim's smile now develops a knowing curl. He turns the bus toward a neighborhood of brick houses, and at the first stop sign, he glances at me and explains. A senior citizen recently flew into a rage because Beth was holding on to her seat, which the lady saw as the optimum place for her to sit as well, he clarifies. "I told the woman very nicely that all 6 of these sideways seats up here are for the elderly and handicapped. She could take any of them. She eventually did, but she sure made her feelings known. Phew, that was some day, wasn't it, Beth?" "Oh, man, she went on," Beth mutters, and then declares, "It doesn't pay to be nice." "Certainly it does," he says. "That's why people admire Abraham Lincoln so much and Eleanor Roosevelt. That's why the Gettysburg Address says, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new kind of bus," I laugh, "conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that the nicer you are, the more they'll leave you alone." Or, as Mahatma Gandhi said, "You ever heard of Mahatma Gandhi?" "No," Beth says, rolling her eyes. "He was from India. Remember, we talked about where that is? And he once said, 'You can kill them with kindness.' He did not, I say." "Then he should have," Tim says. Smiling, I whisper to Beth, "What a great start to the day. He's so personable." She looks at me curiously, and I remember that, with her limited range of vocabulary and difficulty with abstract thought, our communication usually flows more smoothly if I use simple words and rephrase complex concepts so she can follow me more readily. But I wonder if, like Tim, I should just speak as I usually do, $20 words and all, and let Beth ask questions and therefore learn. "What's that mean?" she asks. "Personable? It means he's nice, that he has a pleasing personality." "Yeah," she says with a quick nod. "He's cool."
And cool is the very best thing to Beth.
Cool is as good as it gets.
Yeah. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this caller on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Hi. Rachel, you kind of know a little bit about me because I participate in the same listserv you do.
All right.
My name's Nora, and I have 3 special brothers. And one thing I wanted to tell you that I learned from your book was how to like them better.
Oh, wow. Nora, it is so wonderful to actually hear your voice after all this time. Nora, can we talk a little about the listserv and then talk a little about how you learned to like your brothers better?
Sure.
Am I allowed to ask Nora questions?
Yes.
I hope so. This is SibNet. And Nora, do you want to tell the listeners what SibNet is?
SibNet is a listserv for siblings of people with disabilities and I think we have 193 some people on there right now. And I found it maybe a month or two ago, and it's become a huge part of my life to get to talk to people who have had these experiences and understand what it's like to live with those people, to grow up with them, to be conflicted about them. It's the first thing I do every day is go and see what people have posted on CITINET, and we help each other.
Yeah, it's an incredibly supportive listserv. I'm on a few other listservs, and they're nothing like CITINET. CITINET is a true giving community because we've all shared the same shoes. It's and plus people give information when they have it, but a lot of it is just unconditional emotional support for whatever you are dealing with or did deal with when you were younger. It's amazing, and I do want to, listeners who are interested in it, you can get to CITINET either by going online and probably putting in CITINET, or you can go to my website, and I have a link to it on my links page. So, Nora, how did you start seeing your SIBs differently?
Well, you know, they're three very different personalities. My brother, Patrick, is what I think people sort of stereotypically think of as people that are developmentally disabled, because he's like a kid, and he's happy and funny, and, you know, he's demanding, but he's fun to be around. Mm-hmm. And the other two, my autistic brother, is pretty self-centered, and the world focuses around him, and you have to talk about only the things he likes. And then my other brother is also developmentally disabled, but also bipolar, and he's odd, and all three of them have a selfishness about them in a way. And I saw some of it in what you wrote about Beth. I mean, Beth's very focused on Beth,
mm-hmm.
and these guys are very focused. And two of them live with my older sister, and you know they rarely remember to thank her mm-hmm. for all. She functions like their mother. And I think they're a little bit lower functioning maybe than Beth, but
did you used to feel anger about their lack of gratitude?
Especially my older brother Marty. He lived with me for a year and a half, and you know it was a lot of work, and he didn't see, and he still doesn't see to some extent, how much we do for him. There was that, but you know I think still there was there's the embarrassment factor.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you go out in public with them, and they do odd things. And I think that's where you help. That's one of the things you help me get beyond, and also the acceptance of not trying to control them so much.
Yeah. That's such a big thing, isn't it?
It's huge, and it's interesting. I think it's harder for a SIB than other people. When I would take my brothers out with my husband, I would tell, like, my brother Patrick's to not sing in public, and my husband would say, "Leave him alone," you know. And but you just grew up doing that,
yep.
You know, trying to get them not to stick out.
Yeah, right. And so laying off and just, you know, one of the biggest things for me was going, you know, if Beth behaves in a way that I don't like or that I think other people won't like, they're not looking at me and thinking ill of
mm-hmm.
me, and who even knows if they're thinking ill of her. I mean, she's doing it. They're looking at her. She's got her relation with the world, and it's not really for me to do much about.
It's funny, but I don't know if you've found this, but sometimes you can feel like you're right back in junior high or high school being
yeah.
embarrassed by your sib, and then you have to stop yourself and say, don't do that.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I haven't been back there for a couple years now because of writing the book, but I recognize that it's sort of just beyond where I am, and I could very easily get back there, so I kind of keep monitoring myself. It's always there.
Yeah, and it's funny on the people on CITINET, and I think so many of us are in our 40s and 50s, and we're all struggling with this same stuff this many years after. There are not that many people that live with their SIBs like my sister does.
Yeah.
You know, but they, they all have these long-term struggles that you think they would have gotten over by now.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I wanted to communicate with the book, is that when you have a sibling with special needs, it's a lifelong experience from the day your sibling enters your life until the day you die.
Mm-hmm.
Your sibling, you know, even if your sibling predeceases you, which we know someone on CivNet is dealing with right now, her sister's still always going to be with her, and the person she became because of her sister is always going to be who she is. And some of this is really great stuff, you know,
yeah.
A high tolerance for diversity, an ease with caretaking, and a very giving, compassionate nature. I mean, these are a lot of things that the literature suggests siblings have. But then there are these other great challenges that exist out there that I think some people who haven't been close to someone who's a sibling of a person with special needs, they just don't realize that this is a real thing, and it affects your whole life for your whole life.
And it affects your spouse, and if you have kids, it affects your kids.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, that's so true. I could give examples that would last us the rest of the program.
True, I could hog the whole program with you.
It was really nice of you to call.
Oh, great to hear your voice and
great
to talk
to you.
Take care.
Let us continue at some other time.
All right, thank you, Rachel.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455 is the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Rachel Simon. We're talking with her about her relationship with her sister, Beth. Beth Simon has mental retardation. And how long ago did this project begin that she invited you to ride on the bus?
Let me think.
A couple years now.
Yeah. It was 1999. So how many years ago is that? 2-3 years ago. But certainly the effects continue to reverberate through my life.
Yeah. Anyway, we're talking with Rachel about how Rachel and Beth's relationship changed as a result of the two of them getting together and having had Beth invite Rachel into her life and in fact, into life in general. Riding the Bus with My Sister, Rachel Simon, our guest this afternoon. You can find Rachel on the web at www.rachelsimon.com. Let's talk with another listener on line one, cell phone, or I don't know, is this the same listener or a different listener?
Hello?
Hi, different listener. Okay,
different
go ahead.
Different listener, hi.
Hi.
I'm a parent of a 12-year-old with a disability, and I also have a 16-year-old and a 9-year-old. And I guess I'm wondering from a parent's, you know, you being an adult sibling, do you have any advice for us parents of things we can do to help our typically developing siblings to deal with their other sibling?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I'm really glad you called in, because I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there who are in your shoes. And yes, I do. I'm going to say a few things here, and then you can supplement this by going to the Sibling Support Project, which is actually the organization that runs CivNet, and it runs some other sibling-related stuff, and you can also get to them from a link on my website, and they can give you additional advice. The first thing is to validate what the other children feel. I think one of the things people on CivNet struggle with is some parents put so much energy into the child with special needs that the typically developing children felt very neglected, ignored, that their struggles were treated as trivial. And sometimes these are struggles they might go through on their own anyway, and sometimes they're struggles that have to do with being a sibling. And so recognize that. Spend private time with each of them. Don't rely on them to be the other child's keeper, babysitter. Bring that child into the informational loop. One of the huge problems that really plagues a sibling for life is that parents are given information by the system, whether it's the educational system or the service provider system, and the siblings are never really included. There's just this sort of idea that when educational systems and service providers say family members, that what they mean are parents, and it doesn't occur to the parents to tell the siblings. So, in fact, it wasn't until the night of my 40th birthday or the eve of my 40th birthday that I even learned the definition of mental retardation. No one had ever even explained something that fundamental to me, and let alone the service system that my sister was in and how it worked and what to expect from it and what not to expect and things like self-determination. I was totally out of the information loop. So that's a terribly important part of it, especially because a lot of siblings, whether or not you encourage them to feel this way, do grow up feeling, when my parents pass on, I'm going to be taking on this person. And they may feel fine about this, and they may feel a lot of resentment about this, but if they don't have adequate information, and it actually comes to pass, it's a nightmare. We do have people on SIDNet who've been in this situation, and they don't know where to turn, what to do. Their sibling maybe has lived at home for 50 years, and what now? It's a very difficult place. So keep them informed. Keep them feeling special. Validate their feelings. And check out the Sibling Support Project for some additional advice.
Oh, very good. Thank you. I just wanted to comment that when my daughter was only 7, she one day just had a really, you know, big breakdown. This is my typical child. Mm-hmm. And she was able to verbalize that she was, that it had just gotten too hard to have her brother around, too hard for her and too for us, and that she really thought she would never have a life beyond her brother. She thought she would never go to college, that she would never be without him, and it was really an eye-opening experience to think at 7 she had already felt like her fate was sealed with him.
Wow. You know, I think from what I'm aware of, that's not that uncommon.
Yeah, but we've really worked hard to rectify that situation. She feels a lot better now. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. How did Beth's mental retardation affect your family growing up?
Well, I think, for starters, my parents had a very firm commitment, which in its day was as progressive as it comes, not to put her in an institution. This was the first thing that parents were very often told when a child received a diagnosis. And my parents immediately just made the commitment when she got her diagnosis that she would never be in an institution, that she would be raised as a full part of the family and go to school and be out in the world. And I think that the way this affected us was she was just a regular sister, and also that she was a special sister. So it kind of would depend on the day and what the incident was as to which it was. I think it made us all really appreciate diversity in a way beyond most of our peers, because I should add there's two other siblings.
Mm-hmm.
It also heightened some of our difficulties when she was taunted, and we would always stand up for her and get into fights if necessary. We also went through a period of great trauma when we were teenagers, when my mother disappeared for a while and took Beth, which is a part of the book that I haven't mentioned yet,
mm-hmm.
Which was pretty painful and difficult. My mother was kind of a sad single mother at that point, and my parents had divorced, and she impulsively married somebody who encouraged her to kind of disappear along with my sister, and that was terrifying. It would have been terrifying had it been any of my siblings, but for it to be Beth, who at the age of 15, which is when it happened, was quite a vulnerable person, as strong-willed as she was still a vulnerable person, that was terrifying beyond belief. I didn't sleep for the months that she was gone, living in fear of what was happening. So I think that affected us all and heightened our desire to protect her. And then when she came back, it again heightened our desire to protect her. I suppose it affected all of us in other ways in the rest of our lives. Always, well, like I say, a heightened awareness of diversity. You just sort of accept the way people are, and if somebody has a disability, they're just a person. And no matter what, they're just a person, and so you don't have to kind of get over bigoted feelings that it seems some other people still have.
Mm. Some people are uncomfortable with Beth, and others are hostile. How does she handle those situations?
And to some extent, it's a learning process. At times, if people directly confront her, and there's some extremely rude people in that city who are busybodies, and for reasons that I've never fathomed, will yell in her face, yell things at her. And some of these are, many of them, unfortunately, are senior citizens. They're not teenagers. And there are times when she'll say something back, and most of the time she'll say nothing. What she says back makes a lot of sense to me. Someone said something to her the other day, and she said, "How can you say that? You don't know me. You have no right to say that." And it's true. You know, people will just say things. I think part of what I've come to feel about why this happens, particularly among that population, is when they were 70, 80 years ago, when they were little kids, because I'm talking people who are very senior citizens, they never met people like Beth out in the world, or if they did, it was someone who wasn't really allowed out of the house. These people were kept away from the world, and to have somebody, I mean, she's like a Rosa Parks. She's sitting there in the front of the bus, and you have to deal with her, and I think that is hard for them to tolerate.
What does Beth think of the book?
She's so proud. She carries it around every minute of every day. She's memorized certain passages. It's the first book she's read in probably 25 years, and the first book she's probably ever even picked up that wasn't a picture book. When I first sent her a copy, she was leaving messages on my 800 number saying, "I'm reading it every night. I'm reading it to Jesse, her boyfriend, and my eyes hurt, but it's a very good book. It's a very good book." So she's thrilled beyond belief. She's so proud. And it made me realize that, I don't know why this hadn't occurred to me, but if you write a book about someone you love, and it's a book that's a tribute to them in their fullness, you give someone a priceless gift. So now when I teach students, I can say there's so many reasons to write memoir that aren't particularly good, like getting back at people, but one of the great reasons to write a memoir is to give someone the great gift of having fully understood them and wanted to see the world through their eyes.
Mm. Well, this is a very different kind of kiss-and-tell memoir, isn't it?
Well, I believe very firmly that if you are going to write a memoir, it's very important to do so with compassion. It's far too easy to want to just seek revenge, and I think it's worth getting to a point in your life where you understand to the best extent possible why people do what they do, and you see to someone's depth when you look at someone, and that you write that way. So the world comes to understand them rather than side with you against them. And not that I would have wanted to do that with Beth or, for that matter, my mother. I wanted the world to feel compassionate toward them because I do.
Yeah. Beth is still riding the bus.
Is the sky blue?
Now, has anything about riding the bus changed as a result of this book, Riding the Bus with My Sister?
Well, before this, everyone in her city knew her because it's a city where everyone rides the bus. Now, they know there's a book out, and I think for some of them, this is a total thrill, and many of them have been running out to get it. For some of them, it has shown them up. Some drivers have reported to me that they've heard people on the bus saying, "Oh, that's a nothing book. That book doesn't mean anything." And they'll say, "Well, it's appeared in Reader's Digest, and it's appeared in Rosie Magazine, and it's a real book here, and they'll show it to them. And so these people who wish to dismiss my sister as nothing, and therefore dismiss a book about her as nothing, are put in their place. One hopes they turn this into some level of introspection where they think, maybe I ought to rethink this. It's perhaps unlikely, but I prefer to take an optimistic view.
Hmm. The time has flown by.
It has.
which is very cool.
Cool indeed.
Cool indeed. Rachel Simon, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Celeste.
Rachel Simon has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for her book, Riding the Bus with My Sister, A True Life Journey. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. And look for Rachel Simon on the World Wide Web. Her website, www.rachelsimon.com. That interview was conducted on September 5th of 2002. This evening, April 28th, Rachel Simon will speak at the Carl Forum in Urbana, the event made possible with support from the CUMTD, the Developmental Services Center, and WILL. Social time from 6 to 7:30. Her talk begins at 7:30. We have tickets to the event. If you'd like to go, give us a call. Be one of the first callers, and we'll see that you get a reserved seat. The number to call to get some tickets here this afternoon, 333-7300, 333-7300, to see Rachel Simon this evening at the Carl Forum in Urbana. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Hup, Todd Gleason here. Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished like this for the day. In the corn and the wheat pit, lower for the day, erasing most of yesterday's gains. In the bean pit, the deferred months erasing just a bit more, not much, but a bit more than yesterday's gains. That on ideas that the Chinese government raising their interest rates would put some pressure on the market not to import U.S. soybeans in the future, and that pushed the new crop down fairly sharply, about 20 cents in the nearby November, actually down 19.5 cents. The September was down 20.5. The May yesterday, you might remember, that's the nearby contract, was up 38.5 cents. It took 6.5 cents off that market for the day. Let's begin in the wheat pit for the day. May futures there, down 5.75. Had a high today of 378.5, a low at 370, a settlement price at 372.5. July contract, 387.5, the high, the low at 379, settled 382.5, 6 cents lower. September contract for the wheat, 393, the high, the low at 385.75, settled 388.5, down 5.25, and the December contract, 403.5, the high, the low at 395, settled at 398.5. They were down 5.75 on the day. The nearby May corn, 309.25 high for the day, the low at 304.75, settled close to the top at 308.25, just a penny lower for the day. July futures, 315.5, the high, low at 310.5, settled 314.25, down a penny and a quarter. September contract, 312.25 high, low at 307.75, settled 311.25, down 2.75. And December corn, 311, the high, the low at 306, settled 310. They were down 2 cents. March futures, 314.25, the high, the low at 309.75, settled 313.5, a penny and 3/4 lower. And the May contract, 315, the high, low at 312.25, settlement for that May next year's 315, down 2 cents. July futures of 05, 315.25, the high, the low at 312.25, settlement there, down 2.25. And they finished the day at 314.75. December 2005 corn, 276.25, the high, the low at 275. Settlement price for that 2 years out, 275.25, down 2 cents in the December contract. May oats, 172.5, the high, the low at 169.5, settled 171.75, down a half cent. And July futures, 179, the high, the low at 176, settlement price at 179, and they finished a half cent lower for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby May contract did not have nearly as many losses as the July on out. That in part because there continue to be reports from Brazil that that crop is shrinking in size. Another report out today that pegged the crop around 50.5 million metric tons. There's a report due out tomorrow. We'll see where the crop comes in. May beans, $10.05. The high, the low at 987. Settled 996.5, down 6.5 cents. We'll talk all about that this afternoon with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services during the closing market report at 6 after the next hour. 993, the high in the July beans today, low at 971, settled 980, down 14.5. In the August, 936, the high, the low at 916, settled 918, down 18.25. In September, 20.5 cents lower for the day, 809, the high, the low at 792, settled 793, down 20.5 cents. November futures, 747, the high, the low at 728, settled 732.5, down 19 cents. And the January, 749, the high, the low at 729, settled 730.5, down 21. March futures in the bean pit, 737, the high, the low at 723, settled 726, they were down 17.75. May bean meal for the day, 309, the high, the low at 304, settled 306.5, down 170. And July meal, 307.80, the high, the low at 302.50, settled 305.50, down 150. May bean oil, 34.30, the high, the low at 33.50, settled 33.58, down 68. And the July futures, 33.95, the high, the low at 33.03, settled 33.09, down 86 for the day. Here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Higher day today on the Merc. April feeder cattle, 95.77 and a half. The high, the low, 95.60. The settlement, 95.77 and a half. That up 20. May, 97.35. The high, 94.75. The low, 97.07 and a half. The settlement, that up 227 and a half. August, 98.25. The high, 95.45. The low, 98.12 and a half. The final price, that up 262.5. April live cattle, 86.90, the high, 84.10, the low, 86.82.5, the settlement, that up 265. June, 80.80, the high, 77.70, the low, 80.45, the settlement, that up 262.5. August, 82.35, the high, 79.65, the low, 82.17.5, the settlement, that up 222.5. October, 83.10, the high, 80.80, the low, 83.05, the settlement, that up 222.5. May lean hog, 73.12.5, the high, 72.10, the low, 73.07.5, the settlement, that up 167.5. June, 72.70, the high, 71.90, the low, finishing at 72.65, up 137.5. July, 73.75, the high, 72.75, the low, 73.62.5, the settlement, that up 117.5. August, 71.40, the high, 70.50, the low, 71.25, the settlement, that up 105. May bellies, 109.90, the high, 106.90, the low, 109.65, the final price, that up 185. The Dow currently down 110 points, the NASDAQ off 31, the S&P 500 13 lower.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Here's a good one from Glenn Williams and Armin Crawford, Malcolm Bliss Mental Health Center, St. Louis, Missouri. Dear Dr. Science, why can't a person tickle themselves?
Well, first of all, let me correct your English. The question should be phrased,